In South Africa today, the U.S. run in the World Cup sadly came to an end. In the previous match against the U.S. squad, the U.S. squad pulled off a last-second goal against Algeria, but today it was their opponent, Ghana, who defeated the U.S. 2-1. NPR's Mike Pesca joins me now from Rustenburg in South Africa. Mike, it didn't turn out the way, obviously, we wanted it today, but it was a great match. I mean, both these teams played very, very well, right?
The U.S. came up against a very skilled opponent. And this Ghanaian team, they were the only African team to make it to the knockout round. Before the tournament started, they were considered a very strong side. And they're usually the home continent advantage in the World Cup. But what happened was their most important player, Michael Essien, was injured. And the Ghanaians, even though they made it through group play, they actually didn't score a goal during regular play. Mm. Both of their goals happened on penalty kicks. So it was quite a shock to the United States and maybe the soccer-watching world when they came out and within just a few minutes of the opening kick, a guy by the name of King Prince Boateng became a royal pain to the U.S. He beat U.S. goalkeeper Tim Howard cleanly, and from there the United States had to play catch-up.
Yeah, but Mike, I mean, looking at the American team, I mean, once again, it was Landon Donovan who played just brilliantly.
Yeah, I've become a big Landon Donovan admirer during this tournament. He scored the United States' only goal. The circumstances were that Clint Dempsey was pulled down in the Ghanaian box and a penalty kick was awarded. Unlike in basketball, where the guy who is fouled has to take the shot, the coach can designate anyone to take the shot, so they let Landon Donovan take it. Penalty shots are about an 85 to 90% proposition in soccer. Donovan drilled at home. In doing so, he became the all-time leading scorer in goals, and also he tied the score, and that put it into the overtime period, which was to last a half hour, and if it still ended in a tie, it was going to be penalty kick. But the Ghanaians scored. It scored pretty early. And from there, it was just 2 hours of soccer, but the United States could not get the equalizer.
Now, Mike, I'm hearing a lot of vuvuzelas behind you, and I hear them behind you almost every time you're on the air. Ghana, obviously, the only African team left. Have South Africans there basically adopted them as their team now?
You know, the United States sent almost 10,000 people to the World Cup. They traveled well. They supported their team well. A hair short of 40,000 people were in the stadium today, and it really, right now, there are about 20,000 disappointed Americans and 20,000 brand Ghanaians leaving. It was an evenly matched side, but you're right, most South Africans do support the African team, and there's this real conception of this World Cup as an African World Cup. One of the songs that everyone sings has the lyric, "Do it for Africa," and everyone screams that part. So yes, the whole continent behind the black stars of Ghana.
Mike, obviously, it's been an amazing run for the U.S. team. What's the takeaway here? I mean, what did the U.S. team prove?
Yeah, I think going into the tournament, the expectation for the break-even point would be to get exactly where the U.S. got, which is to make the knockout round. That doesn't say that exiting early is a disappointment, because the ride along the way was so exciting. They certainly won over many fans in the United States. And before we dismiss the idea of barely meeting expectations, why don't you ask the French and the Italians if they would have liked to have just met expectations? So the United States is a tough team, and I was very impressed with Ghana. They're very skilled, and now that they're scoring, they really could make the semifinals, I think. Some experts disagree and pick Uruguay.
All right. Well, you're the only expert that counts. That's NPR's Mike Pesca in Rustenburg, South Africa. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We live in a time where we expect to see extraordinary things before our eyes. Spaceships streaking between stars, dinosaurs returning to life, whole planets blossoming with beautiful blue people. So how do you expect to impress people just by sawing someone in half or picking the ace of spades out of a deck of cards? But magic can still enthrall us. Anyone with an interest in what must be the world's oldest other profession might want to schedule a visit to the Conjuring Arts Research Center. It's a small, dark library in the shadow of the Empire State Building in New York City, crammed to the rafters with personal letters from magicians and books on magic that predate Columbus. William Kalush is the founder of the center. He says magic goes way, way back.
What's the oldest thing we know about?
Yeah.
There's an Egyptian papyrus in the Berlin Museum that tells a story of a magician named Didi, of Desdenefru, doing an effect for King Cheops, of the great, famous for building the Great Pyramid. And he does a thing where he takes an animal and decapitates it and takes its head. I think he used a duck, and shows that its head's over here and the body's over here, and he puts them back together, and the duck is perfectly fine and goes on to live.
Wow.
And I've heard academics talk about this papyrus, and they say, well, no, these are fairy tales. But I know as a magician, this can be done.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we created a method to do this, and then actually performed this a few years back on a television show, and it really just looks like that. It looks like you've taken a chicken, we use the chicken, taken its head off, here's its head, here's its body, and you put it back together. And now put that 5,000 years ago. This papyrus is about 2,500 BC, so it's pretty close to 5,000 years old.
Yeah.
So that's the earliest, but then there's a big gap, and we start getting stories about magicians performing things that we would recognize again about the time of Christ, about the first century AD. And then books start to be written telling mm-hmm. secrets, and there's some really good things that we could still use as magicians today that were written 2,000 years ago.
Like what?
Well, what can I tell you without tipping too much? There are ways to read minds that are 2,000 years old that still work. There are methods to take your hands in front of the entire audience without any sort of covering, take a pot of oil, put it on a fire. When it starts to boil, you put your hands in the oil, take them out.
Yeah.
They're fine. Now you throw the vegetables in, which start to cook, and you can make dinner. And this is a method that's still great and would still fool anybody today, yet it's 2,000 years old.
You've done that?
I haven't done it personally. Right. I would, though. I mean, we've thought about it.
This is something like this Jamie Oliver should do on a show.
This could absolutely be done.
I don't want Nigella to harm herself. But in any event, I don't want Jamie Oliver to harm himself either. But in any event.
But then there's a jump again, and then when books start happening. Now, there's lots of record of books, of non-printed books. If you'd like to go into the rare book room.
Yeah, please.
I'll show you some of the things that we've managed to collect here.
Okay.
It's a little bit warm, but I'm not going to turn the air on because of
this place is beautiful.
Thank you.
And a huge show posters here of, if I knew my conjurers a little better.
Well, there's Carmi. Buried alive for 32 days. Actually was an American, wasn't Indian at all, professed to be an Indian. Sanus, who had, now this is in the 30s, would memorize well in excess of 100,000 telephone numbers. The books, this is where we keep all the books printed and the manuscript books before 1900. And the earliest complete book we have, originally it was written in about 1280.
Mm-hmm.
The first time it was printed was in the 1470s. This example's from about 1480.
Mm.
And it was printed in Rome, and it's in Latin. And this particular book is attributed to Albertus Magnus. He's now a saint, but he wrote about a lot of interesting things. And in this book, he writes about secrets,
mm-hmm.
and one of which is how to take a dead fly and resuscitate it, bring it back to life. And here it is, written in the 13th century and printed in the 15th century.
Now, if I asked you, how do you resuscitate a dead fly, would it be against the code for you to tell me?
I wouldn't tell you, no. I might tell you the path you might take to go find that method yourself. For example, I've already told you that it's somewhere in this book in medieval Latin. You might be able to find a copy of this book someplace and find somebody who can translate it and then tell you what the method is. I wouldn't mind helping you find the method, but I wouldn't want to just tell you the method, because what we're doing here is teaching more than just exposing secrets.
Show a man how to do a magic trick and he does a magic trick for a day. Teach him how to do a magic trick and he does magic for life.
Right. Entertain him for an hour, or teach him how to entertain for the rest of his life. One of the things we do here is we have an outreach program where we send professional magicians into hospitals, and they teach kids in hospitals, kids in community centers and also kids in detention centers how to do magic. Mm-hmm. And it's really not about physical therapy. It's really about mental therapy. It's about the ability to project yourself and to show a little initiative and build self-esteem.
But I'm interested in this because the whole like with a kid is considered to be at risk. He mm-hmm. or she learns how to do a series of magic tricks, and it lifts their
Absolutely.
Definition of themselves.
Absolutely. It's all about feeling like you've got some power over your own life, because it's not just about performing tricks. We don't like that word trick. And, you know, sometimes magicians use it, but I think it's the wrong word. Yeah. I think that it's really about an effect and about a performance and about magic. And so what we teach these children and the veterans is about having a power. And the power is maybe I can read minds. Maybe I want to have the power to put a solid object through a solid object. And so we create a small set of powers and let the kids choose what power they want to have. It's pretty exciting.
There's so much that we can look at now, and for that matter, youngsters are growing up with now, that seems like magic, that we know is done by special effects, and it's done by computer graphics, and it just, I mean, you see astonishing things. Whole worlds are created that way. Has that made it rougher for magic, conjuring?
I think, to be honest, it's a great question. I'm glad you asked. And I think that it's made it not rougher. I think it's actually opened the door even wider for us. Because one of the reasons it's special is because a great performance of magic always involves the audience. Mm-hmm. Whether they pick this card or whether they choose this, or when it's a mind-reading effect, what have I done with this and what am I thinking? These are all things that affect the outcome of the show. So the audience becomes integral. And I think because of that factor, as long as magicians continue to use that, all of this technology, whether it's in film, whether it's the iPad, which looks like magic to me, I don't think it's going to affect the performer.
What's the importance of keeping conjuring going?
Well, I think a day without wonder is really a terrible day. I think that what keeps people, what keeps science moving forward, what keeps our human spirit is curiosity and wonder. And I think that as magicians, what we can do when the performer is accomplished, we can give you a peek into what a world would look like if magic were real. I think that if we can allow our audience to feel like there's real wonder and magic in the world, then we've done our job.
Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Nice talking to you. Thanks.
Yeah,
for
this
all
was wonderful.
William Kalush, founder of the Conjuring Arts Research Center in New York. We have nothing up our sleeve. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Bertie Baker is a beautiful and ambitious woman who uses her derriere to get ahead in Hollywood. You can take that phrase in all ways. She ran out on her life in a small town in Virginia, where she had a nice husband, close family, active church, to go to Hollywood, where she struggled and strived for 9 years, but so far, her best gig has been to have her derriere double for the backside of a Hollywood star. She auditions almost every day. Once in a while, she gets a line in a commercial. The way Bertie Baker tries to handle the guilt of leaving her family, her desire to get ahead, frustration, and loneliness is all at the heart of Jenny Hollowell's new book, her first novel, Everything Lovely, Effortless, Safe. Jenny Hollowell joins us from NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know this territory, both professionally and personally, don't you?
I do. I grew up in a very religious family. We were Jehovah's Witnesses. So that aspect is certainly personal. And then I've also worked as a producer for TV commercials for the past 10 years. So I've had a lot of exposure to that world, been sitting through a lot of auditions with actors who are very hopeful, mm-hmm. trying to get the part, and so I've seen sort of that struggle take place in front of me as well.
in this novel, Birdie, well, she has a lot of reasons to be mortified from her point of view. She's at her age, which I guess is what, about 29?
Yes, 29 or 30.
She's still house-sitting.
Yeah.
In the guest house of a very successful, wealthy producer. She is the she's the derriere of of a better known star, and then when she gets a good offer, it's for a tampon commercial.
Yes, she has had a series of disappointments, and it's funny how the things that feel like victories at first begin to feel like disappointments. I'm sure the first commercial role, there was a big celebration. You know, that's an exciting thing to happen. But after 9 years and still being a body double, still getting those one lines, I think she certainly had hoped for more.
She feels some guilt for leaving her husband, Judah, who just seems in the early chapter like an awfully nice guy, but not enough to keep her in small-town Virginia.
It's true. Well, she seems certainly like a person who didn't examine the reasons for marrying him very closely before actually doing it.
He really did understand her.
I think so. And I think, you know, I mean, it's hard to say why people do what they do. But I think in my mind, the reason she left had less to do with him and more to do with herself. I mean, I know it sounds sort of like it's not you, it's me kind of thing. But, you know, he was a nice and decent man. But, she certainly was ambitious, and the nature of their life and their marriage was not going to fulfill whatever it was that she felt like she needed to do.
One day, Birdie meets a beautiful and beguiling young actor, Lewis.
Yes.
She thinks a guy that good, she can't be any good for him.
I think that he has this realness, and I'm saying real sort of with air quotes in a very Hollywood way. He has a realness that she has sort of been known for, and I think maybe is a little afraid of losing, because she's been in Hollywood for an awfully long time. So, not, you know, I don't think she's completely aware of how she's in some ways a vampire in his life, you know, trying to suck out some of that realness for herself.
People outside of Hollywood think of Hollywood, understandably, some of the concentration, a lot of the concentration is on major names, recognizable stars, kind of people who have to wear sunglasses to avoid being recognized.
That's right.
This is a Hollywood novel you write about, well, is it a Hollywood novel? It's set in Hollywood, and you write it about the kind of people who stand close enough to Harrison Ford or Katy Perry in a Starbucks line to touch them, but feel that they're in a separate universe.
Yes. You know, I think that is one of the strange and difficult things about living in Los Angeles, if you are an actor. I'm not an actor, but I'm, you know, I am a person living in Los Angeles, and it's bizarre the proximity you have to very famous people sometimes. And I think, you know, being an actor in this city, you do have this proximity to the people who are doing what it is that you want to do. You are literally this close to what it is that you want. And for it to remain unattainable would really be maddening.
Am I wrong reading this book to infer that you make some kind of link between faith and show business? You know, let us celebrate the mystery of creation.
I think you're right about that. I think that it's something that really sort of fascinated me. I was having trouble understanding how this could be, how we could, as a sort of American culture, be obsessed with celebrity to the degree that we are, but also be in this period of real sort of religious fervor. From an outside viewpoint, it seems sort of contradictory, but I think that the promises of celebrity in many ways mirror the promises of religion. The idea of being special and remembered, and that's a really human sort of desire. And whether you're acting that out in your religious faith in trying to build a real relationship with God, or whether you're a very ambitious, you know, young person standing in line at a reality show, you're still trying to be seen and to be remembered in some way.
Jenny Hollowell, her new novel, Everything Lovely, Effortless, Safe. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For 25 years, scientists in Mountain View, California, have been manning listening stations, hoping not to miss the moment aliens make contact with us humans. The place is known as the SETI Institute. It was inspired by the famed astronomer Carl Sagan. And the idea was to use radio telescopes to listen to the cosmos, just in case. Sagan's first doctoral student was David Morrison, and this week he took over as the new head of the Institute's Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe. He's in Mountain View. David Morrison, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So after 25 years, how do you measure SETI's success? I mean, it was set up to find alien life. Why are you convinced there is life out there?
One of the greatest discoveries in astronomy of the last few years is that there are thousands of planets around other stars. The Kepler mission of NASA is now discovering better than one new planet a week. So we know that the habitats exist where there's a potential for life.
And for the record, and please feel free to break some news here, you haven't yet made contact, right? Or perhaps you have something to announce?
Don't I wish I did.
Ah.
The way we know is when we hear the champagne corks popping, and I think the champagne is pretty old.
I got you. Okay. But what is the difference between a scientist who studies and searches for intelligent life from a scientist who, you know, does things like look for microbes in asteroids or Martian ice?
The people who are searching for signals are the kind who would go for the jackpot in gambling. Other scientists, perhaps a little more conventional, take on problems that they think they can answer. Whether there are microbes on Mars is something we will know in the next 10 or 15 years from our continuing spacecraft. So a person doing basic astrobiology has a prospect of finding answers within her or his lifetime.
Dr. Morrison, Stephen Hawking recently said we shouldn't be trying to contact aliens because if we're successful, there's a good chance they might come visit us and wipe us out. Does he have a point?
Sure, he has a point, but I don't agree with all parts of it. First, of course, we are not transmitting our presence. And in that, I think we'd all agree with Hawking that that's not the right thing to do. Secondly, if we did get radio contact with some civilization hundreds or thousands of light years away, the chances of their being able to come here from just the basic laws of physics are very low. Most of the people I work with are not worried about that.
Your predecessor, Frank Drake, he pioneered the now famous Drake equation, which estimates the number of intelligent civilizations in the Milky Way. Firstly, can you explain briefly how that equation works?
The Drake equation is a conceptual way to address this problem. You just start asking, how many civilizations are there? Well, nobody knows. But you break it down into components. How many planets? How many planets that might be Earth-like? What fraction of those are going to have life start? What fraction of those will develop technology and so forth? And so you can break this problem down into individual pieces. You still can't plug in a number and get an answer. But it helps you wrap your mind around what's otherwise a rather awesome question about the existence of life elsewhere.
By the time your directorship is over, what do you hope you would have been able to find or to discover?
I'd like to take a longer perspective because I probably won't be in this job for more than 2 or 3 years. By the time I die, which I hope will be 20 years from now, I think we have a good chance of having determined if there is or ever was life on Mars. I think we will have found many planets that are truly Earth-like planets beyond our own solar system, which is where the astronomers will direct their big telescopes to look for evidence that there might be life on those Earth-like planets.
That's David Morrison. He's the new director of the SETI Institute's Carl Sagan Center for Study of Life in the Universe. David Morrison, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Time now for a look back at the week's news. Joined now by NPR senior news analyst Dan Schor. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And Dan, let's begin with the story that dominated so much attention this week.
Yes.
And that's story in a magazine, not a website, story in Rolling Stone magazine, that led to the resignation firing of General Stanley McChrystal,
mm-hmm.
head of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. What are your thoughts?
Well, the first temptation is to go back into history and say, hey, didn't we have something like General MacArthur, who was fired by President Truman because he wanted to go into China? And yet you think about it, and it isn't quite the same. Mm-hmm. This is not really a policy difference. This is somehow personality tensions somewhere between the general and various civilians. I also think that it was probably something that President Obama hated to do more than anything. He really hates this kind of confrontation, and yet he had no recourse. There was no way not to fire a guy who had allowed to be published in print remarks that were critical of the administration.
Yeah, personalities in the administration, not the mission itself.
Right.
How do you think the replacement of General McChrystal by David Petraeus and the entire ball of wax of recent events may affect the war in Afghanistan?
I'm not quite sure. I think we'll find out more about this next Tuesday mm-hmm. when General Petraeus appears before the Senate Armed Services Committee on confirmation in his post. I think senators will find the opportunity to ask a lot of questions about how the war is going. The war, as we know, has not been going very well.
General Petraeus, at one point, according to reports, had been uneasy about putting that July 2011 deadline on,
yes.
As beginning to withdraw U.S. troops. He accepted it as part of the policy. And obviously President Obama has appointed him now. But what's the state of that disagreement between civilian leadership in the White House that wants to set a deadline, knows it's popular,
right.
and military forces on the ground that believe setting a deadline might give some kind of organizational advantage to the Taliban?
Well, no general wants to set a deadline. He wants to know that if necessary, he can call for more troops and keep on fighting until he wins. Setting deadlines are political things to do. And therefore, I think there is a certain amount of tension over that. They have several deadlines now. They're supposed to know by December what they want to do next. Starting July of next year, they're supposed to start pulling out troops. The president said, we didn't say we were going to pull out a lot of troops then. We will pull out some troops then. They're already beginning to back off a little bit. And it gets to be very difficult for them.
And this week, President Obama met with the President of Russia, whose name you can pronounce much better than I can.
Medvedev, but then I worked in Moscow.
All right, you did indeed. In any event, they had a lot to talk about. I wonder if they had a lot to agree about.
Well, they certainly picked on everything they could agree about, including, for example, sending poultry products to Russia. All the nice little things they could do, they trotted out. Also very important is the fact that Russia supported the United States both against North Korea and Iran, and that's very important. On the other hand, there are still big problems between them, as, for example, the United States' intention of having a missile defense system in Europe and so on. And so we get the better side of this. They come out and have a hamburger together, a special kind of cheeseburger, all say nice things to each other, and things go on. That is, some things they agree upon, some things they don't agree about, but if they emphasize the areas of agreement, everybody will feel good.
Explain something to me, Dan, with your perspective on events in Russia, where you note you were based in Moscow for important years during the Khrushchev regime. The president of Russia had jalapenos on his hamburger.
Yes.
Does this say something about the change in Russia, the fact that a Russian president would openly have jalapenos?
Well, I'll tell you, my friend Khrushchev would have had them too, if he had known about it.
All right. Dan, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore.